This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Like many communities in the Driftless area, the city of Arcadia has faced major floods in the last decade. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has been working with the city to create a plan for how to reduce the risk of flooding, and the agency recently released its draft plan for a $36.8 million project. Joining us to talk about the proposed project is Nan Bischoff, project manager from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers St. Paul District. Nan, I wonder if you could start by talking a little bit about how this project got started, how the Corps got involved with the city of Arcadia.
Yes, Hope, I'd be glad to. The Corps and the city of Arcadia began working together back in 2012 when the city asked the Corps for assistance under the Corps' Section 205 program. Prior to that, in 2010, the city had incurred roughly $12 million in damages due to flooding from the rivers around Arcadia.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, why there is such a high flood risk in Arcadia. Kind of maybe for those who aren't familiar with the community, kind of what are the threats in that area for flooding?
Yeah, Arcadia, rather the area that we studied in this study, is that portion of Arcadia that's bordered by Turton Creek to the north, and Myers Valley Creek to the south, and the Trempealeau River to the west. So the portion of Arcadia that we studied is surrounded by water on three sides, and that adds to their problem with flooding.
I wonder how that element influence the way you guys approach this project of studying the flooding issues. I mean, I imagine that had a major influence on just the fact that there are these three main presences that could potentially lead to flooding.
That's right. And flooding could come from snowmelt in the spring, from mostly from the Trempealeau River. It could also be coming from a heavy rainfall, especially on the Myers Valley Creek or Turton Creek, because they have a very fast buildup to flood once rainfall comes in. But if you get a combination of both spring snowmelt and rainfall at the same time, that's when you really run into problems.
You mentioned the 2010 flood that really impacted the community there. I wonder what lessons the Corps was able to kind of take away from that flooding event in particular, as far as, you know, how the city should respond to their flood risk.
Well, from 2012, it was an extreme flood, and we were able to determine just how bad the flooding in Arcadia could get. Like I said, that was probably the highest flood that they had in the last 100 years of flooding. And from that event, we were able to determine where the flood threats were coming from.
I know Arcadia also faced a major flood in 2017. And, you know, were there any, how did that shape the planning process for the study?
Yes, that did occur. They had flooding in July of 2017, and that was originated from a rainfall on Turton Creek. And during that event, I think we were just reminded of how precarious Arcadia's situation was.
I wonder if you could explain the different components of the draft plan that the Corps has released at this point and is currently taking public comment on. You know, the Corps seems to be kind of taking more than one type of approach to help manage flood risk.
Yes. Arcadia is unique in that it is bordered by those three rivers, or the two creeks and the river, and there's not a lot of room to construct levees. So we've had to come up with some different solutions. Along Turton Creek, we were able to fit in a levee on the south side of the creek, but in order to do that, we did have to move the creek slightly to the north, and we did have to buy out four homes in order to do that. Where we had a little less room to work with, we are putting in a flood wall, and that is mainly along the Trempealeau River. And in the vicinity of the Ashley Furniture Industries, where a flood wall or a levee might be more disruptive to their 24-hour, 7-day-a-week operation. We are instead switching to something called engineered high ground, where we are simply raising the Ashley parking lot up to slightly higher than the adjacent levees.
Can you explain what goes into moving a creek? Because I think that that feels like a major step to kind of change the path of a waterway.
Yeah. Well, the first thing you have to do is dig the new creek bed, and then you can move the levee closer or, you know, fill in the old creek bed.
Is that a common practice that the Corps does?
I think we like to avoid impacts to streams like that. There are two small portions along Turton Creek that need to be realigned in order to make room for the levee. I think there's roughly just over 1,000 linear feet of stream bed that needs to be moved. And when we do have an impact, that would be an environmental impact to whatever effect that we have on the stream, we do have to mitigate for that by making up for loss of stream length in some other area. So it's something we try to avoid or we try to minimize.
You also mentioned that this project includes buying out 4 residential structures. It also includes buying out some commercial structures. Can you explain kind of how the Corps approaches that and maybe what the response has been from those, you know, residents or businesses that could be directly affected by this change?
Yeah, during the course of the study, we did look at several different alternatives, and the impact is mainly along Turton Creek, where 4 homes do need to be bought out and 2 commercial structures need to be purchased and removed. And during the course of the study, we looked at different alternatives that would maybe have different impacts. Some of what we looked at had involved 4 homes rather than, or sorry, 10 homes rather than the 4 that are being impacted. And we looked at different ways to minimize, I guess, the impact on homes. And this is the minimum that we could come up with that was still cost effective.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. We're talking about a proposed project in the city of Arcadia to reduce the risk of future flooding. We're here with Nan Bischoff, project manager from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers St. Paul District. As I mentioned in the intro, this project has an estimated cost of $36.8 million to implement. The Corps has around $9 million to contribute to that implementation, and the state legislature has also allocated around $14.5 million for the project. But I wonder, is there a concern for the viability of this project, just the remaining cost that is needed to be covered by the city of Arcadia?
I know that the city is concerned about the remaining costs, and if we were to separate that $36.8 million, you're right, approximately $9 million would be able to be funded by the federal government, leaving about $28 million to be funded locally. If you subtract what the state of Wisconsin has authorized for this project, that, you know, we are still left with $13 to $14 million that would have to be funded by the city of Arcadia. And I know that that will be a challenge, but we have some time yet to get funding in place.
And what happens if the city is unable to come up with all of that money?
I don't know if I have a good answer for that. I mean, I think right now we're pretty early in the process to make those kinds of decisions. First, we're just trying to get through the feasibility phase, and then we'll move into design and construction.
So I know when the Corps is studying this plan, you guys look at the return on investment that comes with this project. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, how we know this investment is worth it when it comes to managing flood risk.
Yes. when we look at the feasibility of any project, we try to compare the average annual costs of implementing the project, you know, designing and constructing it, and compare those to the average annual benefits that we can derive from the project once it's in place. And those benefits come in the form of flood damages prevented. In the case of Arcadia, our benefit to cost ratio is 1.64 to 1, meaning that for every dollar we spend, we get a $1.64 return on our investment.
You know, many communities in the Driftless area have been faced with what they feel like is a changing environment, a changing climate, and where we see more of these severe flash flood events, and they're becoming more common. You know, how did the Corps kind of take that into consideration as it's planning for this?
Yeah, as part of the study and part of our hydraulic analysis, we do have to look at climate change in more of a qualitative format rather than a quantitative format. So we do discuss it in the report, maybe just in the term of trends in rainfall or, you know, wet cycles.
So the Corps and the City of Arcadia held an open house for residents there to kind of learn more about this draft plan, ask questions, weigh in. Can you talk a little bit about attendance at that meeting? Did you see a lot of people come out?
Yes, we had a public meeting on the evening of January 22nd up at the high school in Arcadia. We estimate that approximately 40 people attended, which is pretty good attendance. And we talked about the project, and, you know, we heard some concerns and invited folks to provide comments to us.
Yeah, can you share some of those concerns that you heard? Any trends in kind of what people were talking about?
I think the biggest concern we heard was the high cost of the proposed project at $36.8 million. I mean, that is kind of a tall order for a small community like Arcadia. Other concerns I heard were the upstream and downstream communities were concerned about what the potential impacts of this project could be on their communities as well.
That's an interesting aspect. I wonder if that's something the Corps looked at in your guys' study.
Yes, we did, to an extent. When we're studying a project, we develop a hydraulic model that tells us what the river elevations are doing both with the project and without the project, so existing conditions and proposed conditions. And we extend the model to the point or slightly past the point where we see zero difference between existing conditions and with project conditions. So there was a comment during the public meeting that one gentleman thought that the model didn't extend far enough. It was either upstream or downstream, but, you know, we did do our due diligence and we showed where the effects of the project begin and end.
So the public has until February 14th to weigh in on this draft plan. What happens with those public comments? You know, how does the Corps respond or take them into consideration?
Well, there are a couple of things that will happen. There are two types of comments, actually, we're looking for. One is with comments on our environmental assessment. And did we come to the right conclusions through our environmental assessment? The other thing that the comments could be used for is verification to the City of Arcadia on whether they want to proceed with the project or not. So that's the type of feedback we would consider as we move forward. When we get to finalizing the report, then we will be requesting that the City of Arcadia give us another letter of intent or a letter of support for moving forward. And I think that they would consider any public comments that we've received in writing that letter.
What has your relationship been like with city administration when it comes to this project? You know, have there been challenges in kind of communicating back and forth about kind of the future of this community really is, you know, a big part of this project?
I think our partnership has been very good. We openly communicate issues and costs, and, you know, the costs do go up, and we have communicated that. I do meet with them biweekly just for a check-in meeting. We involve them along the way as things develop. We shared the draft report with them before it went public, and the city has also contributed to the contents of the report in that they developed a floodplain management plan, and we've also worked with the city's engineer as well as we developed the report.
And so you mentioned that, you know, the Corps will kind of respond to these public comment. You know, kind of what happens after that point? How soon could we possibly see construction on this project start?
I think the earliest that we could potentially see construction would be in 2022. Between then and now, meaning the Corps, we have to finish and get approval of our feasibility study. The next step after that would be for the Corps and the City of Arcadia to sign a project partnership agreement. After that, we could start the next phase of design and construction. So construction, I think, could not really realistically begin until the spring of 2022.
How do you think this project will just help with peace of mind, perhaps, for residents in the City of Arcadia?
Well, I know that talking with some residents that they do feel quite a bit of stress whenever there is flooding in the area, you know, watching the floodwaters come up on the existing levees there. So I think that this project will give them more peace of mind. In addition, some of the features that we've included, such as floodgates, or rather swing gate closure structures across two of the roads and one of the railroads, will make flood fighting a lot quicker and easier. They'll be able to prepare for any floods much more quickly.
Nan Bischoff is project manager for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers St. Paul District. She joined us today to talk about a proposed project in the City of Arcadia that would reduce the risk of future flooding. Coming up, we'll talk with former Public Service Commissioner and state lawmaker Mike Hipsch of West Salem, who retired from state government this week. We'll hear about his experience holding a variety of positions in state government over the years. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, WPR.org/newsmakers. Our site has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at WPR.org/newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. Mike Hipsch of West Salem has held many roles in state government over the last 25 years. He was a Republican state representative for the 94th Assembly District, representing much of La Crosse County, before becoming the Speaker of the Assembly. He later became the Administration Secretary for Governor Scott Walker, and was most recently appointed to the Wisconsin Public Service Commission, which approves utility projects. WPR's John Davis recently sat down with Hipsch as he prepared to retire from state government this week.
You know, the one thing that I learned almost right away was then-Senator Brian Rood sat me down right after I won the election, and he said, you know, let me kind of explain how things work. He said, you know, we're Republicans and we're Democrats, and you know, Brian Rudo is a Republican. He said Mark Meyer is in the State Assembly. He's a Democrat. But we work together, because in Western Wisconsin, you have to have a pretty unified voice because we're outmanned. I mean, there's more legislators in other parts of the state. And I took that to heart and worked with Mark Meyer, worked with Brian Rood, worked with Dwayne Johnson at the time, and then, you know, Bobby Gronimus, who was the Democrat from Whitehall, and folks like that. And we recognized that you really do need to, if you're going to be representing Western Wisconsin, you have to be a unified voice. You have to know what it is you're trying to do. Certainly, we had our disagreements as to the role of state government, how much tax money we should be collecting, things like that. But when it came to issues and functions that were going to occur here, the Health Sciences Center here at UW La Crosse, that's one that we all worked together on. And I remember clearly sitting in the Department of Administration Secretary's office and trying to lobby them on the importance of putting that building in the state budget. It's those type of things that I think in as far as what I did early on is I tried to be that, not really team player, but that strong voice for Western Wisconsin that joined the other voices that were already there, and put the partisanship aside when we knew it was something that was important for Western Wisconsin.
Any other projects jump out at you for your district?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, some of our kind of small. I still get a little warm feeling in my heart when I live in West Salem, still have lived, you know, since 97, so quite a while. There's a stoplight right by Brickell Road, right by Brickell, and that's something that, you know, we had to push pretty hard to try and get that in the state budget to make sure we got a stoplight there, because there was some concern about whether or not the traffic was going to handle that, and DOT was saying there's just not enough cars that come through here. And so that's one of those things that, you know, you remember some of those little things. I mean, there's big projects. I mean, I've certainly worked on things for UWL. We've done some things for local communities. It's funny, Governor Thompson just was in the state capitol just yesterday when Vice President Pence mm-hmm. was there. And he stopped into Senator Scott Fitzgerald's office. He's the majority leader. And lo and behold, my son now works for Scott Fitzgerald. He graduated from UW La Crosse. He got a job down there, and he works for him. And Governor Thompson walks in, and Ryan introduced himself. And Governor Thompson said, "Oh my gosh, last time I saw you, I think I was holding you." And it's true. We have a picture of him when he was up here signing the ethanol bill at the old G. Heilman bill, the city brewery,
right?
Back in '96. It's those things that you try to do. We worked on things for Train Company. We worked on all different kinds of projects throughout the years that we thought were going to be beneficial and helpful for Western Wisconsin. And again, those are individual things that come to mind throughout the years, but it's also the big stuff of what we're going to do with education in this state, what we're going to do for human services. W-2 was a huge project that I was involved in right away, and still strongly believe that was the right path to go with what was AFDC. So, lots of things come to mind.
So you moved up the ranks fairly quickly and eventually became Speaker of the Assembly in mm-hmm. 2007.
Yep.
For a brief time, an interesting time in Wisconsin history, a divided government at the time. I believe the Senate was
Democrat.
In control of Democrats. There was a Democratic governor.
Right.
What was that time like in the legislature?
It was at times challenging, at other times kind of surreal. We took the budget and it didn't pass a budget in Wisconsin for the second longest time in our state history. We went to almost Halloween before we'd passed the state budget because we couldn't really come down to an agreement between myself and my caucus, the Republicans who ran the assembly, and the senators the Democratic senators in the Senate and the Governor Doyle. And in the midst of that, the Democrats threw out their leader and brought in a new leader, from Judy Robson. They went to Russ Decker. Senator Decker and Governor Doyle did not get along. There were times when I was playing the in-between those mm-hmm. two. It was a little surreal, but it was, at the same time, it was one of those things where you recognized where you could try to work and compromise, and other areas where you just can't. You just have to draw the line. And I remember, early on, in that process, I stepped in and I saw Governor Doyle and his staff, and he said, well, all right, the Senate's passed their budget, you've passed your budget. What are you going to need in order for us to pass a budget? And I said, well, I'm going to need lower taxes, I'm going to need less spending here and there. And he said, no. I mean, what projects, what stuff will you need to get to line up the votes? And I said, you don't understand. That's not what my caucus is about. They want less spending. They want all these types of things. And I said, the best I could do for you, I think, because he had offered in his budget a dollar tax increase on cigarettes. I said, the best I can do for you is that with some Democrat votes, I could possibly include that in the budget and get that passed. And I don't remember which staff person said. He said, well, if you're not serious about this conversation, why are you even here, Mike? I was like, oh, boy, we're going to be here a long, long time. And that was, that was early July, and we didn't pass the budget until late October. I mean, it's just a fundamental difference in belief and what we should be doing.
Take us back to that time. The economy was not good, as I recall.
It wasn't.
State budget projection, anyway, was like, what, $3.5 billion?
Yeah, the structural deficit, right?
Deficit, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's interesting because I've gone through the highs and lows. I was in the legislature when, in the late 90s, we sent back a rebate check because we had $1 billion more. 6 months after we passed the budget, we had $1 billion more collected than we had anticipated we were going to have. So there was and it was split government at that time as well. Senator Quala and the Democrats at the Senate, Scott Jensen was running the Assembly with the Republicans, and Governor Thompson was there. And so we had to compromise with them. I think we put a quarter of that into higher school aids. We sent $750 million back in a rebate check, and that was 1999. And then 9/11 hits. And all of a sudden, the economy really takes a digger, and we were struggling. Everyone was struggling. The production and productivity had dropped, and there was a real problem. And so we got through that early period, and then you got closer to what was the Great Recession, if you will, of 2008-09. That area, mm-hmm. We were seeing the early warnings of it in 2007, and the deficits that were coming. And you're right, the structural deficit, which I never put much stock in. I mean, the structural deficit it's a marketing tool. I mean, I want to know what the actual numbers are, and the actual numbers were showing us 300 to even as much as $600 million short, and that is huge. That's significant. That's a significant tax increase in order to try to get through that, or huge cuts, and so that was the beginning of it, and that's when the what I call the Obama wave came in 2008 and wiped out all the Republicans, and the Democrats took over from 2009 to the 2009-11 budget, and they raised a bunch of taxes to get us through, but it also was the last time they were in the majority.
Then you became administration secretary for Governor Scott Walker. He was elected in 2010, and right away we have Act 10, and all hell breaks loose at the state capitol. Were you surprised by that?
No. I was surprised by the size. I mean, all of us were surprised by the size. I remember, this also became, this came out of a budget shortfall that we had. We had about a $300 million shortfall as we were coming in. We had to pay back the patient compensation fund, which had, there had been money that had been taken out of that, that the courts had said that the state was not appropriate in taking that, so they had to pay that back. So we came in with a significant budget shortfall, and Governor Walker, and initially when the governor was elected in early November of 2010, he called me a week later and asked me to be his budget director, not the DOA secretary. So from November 10th till late December, I was working on developing the budget and building the budget for him. And so we were going through all the challenges we had as far as how much the shortfall was going to be. And we realized that we were going to have to do some things as far as our workforce was concerned, as far as, reducing spending. And a big portion of that was the retirement and healthcare benefits that state employees were getting mm-hmm. at the time. So, Act 10 was developed in response to that. We announced it on February 11th. By that weekend, we had probably 5,000 people around, that were marching around. And that first weekend was interesting because I was secretary of DOA, but nobody really knew me by face at that point. And so when there were a bunch of people out there, I took my son and one of his friends from here, and we went down in just jeans and sweatshirts and walked with some of those protesters because I just wanted to know what they were talking about. I wanted to know, you know, who we were dealing with. And mainly it was teachers, it was just folks coming from Madison. It was a grassroots type of thing that, yeah, they were bussed in from Eau Claire and, you know, other parts of the state, but it's still, they were there for that particular purpose. And as I said, it was probably 5,000 that first weekend. Well, as we know, within just a couple of weeks, they'd flown in from all over the country. There were, you know, the major media outlets were there, and it grew to 100,000 people. But initially, that 5,000 was a significant number. I had been there, you know, almost 20 years at that point. Well, almost 20, and had not really seen a protest of that size. We had seen, you know, a few hundred at times, but never quite that size. And it was a small number compared to what we were going to see.
Act 10, could you describe how Act 10 came about?
Sure.
I mean, was it truly a reaction to the financial straits the state was in, or was it a series of ideas that conservative politicians had wanted throughout the years?
Mm-hmm.
That kind of all coalesced into this.
Both, and it's a good history, you know, that you recall. Prior to Governor Walker being elected, when John Gard was Speaker and I was Majority Leader, and even before that, when I was on the Finance Committee, we had tried to get state employees to pay for part of their health care. You know, they were at that point, state employees were not paying any part of their health care, and we had passed a motion in one of our committees that was going to require a 5% copay. 5% of health care was going to be paid by the employee. And John Card was burned in effigy on the lawn of the Capitol back in 2005, 2006, something like that. I still have one of the protest signs that wasn't very kind of me and my name. And so they, you know, it's just those type of things that you hang on to just as sentimental, I don't know, but there was, so there, this had been building for some time that it was difficult for us to defend anymore the idea that state employees weren't going to pay anything for their health care, since health care was such a huge issue at the time, and it was so expensive, it was constantly going up. And on top of that, there was also the retirement. you know, not many companies were providing pensions anymore. The state still does provide pensions. But again, at that point, going back to, I think, 1983, there had been a vote that said that the employer was going to pay a portion of it, and then the employee would pay this, it would match that. Up until 1983, when there was a vote in the legislature that said the employer will pay it all. So now, not only were employees not contributing anything to their health care, they weren't contributing anything to their retirement either. And those were two very difficult things to defend. And so we had tried to chip away at those things. And finally, Governor Walker, who had, as county executive in Milwaukee, had seen really, I think, some of the worst abuses of some of the employment rules in Milwaukee County, really had seen enough of it. And he had anecdotal stories of a number of things that really had shown him that there were some abuses here that needed to be changed. That's where we wanted to go in there and obviously try to save the dollars because we were $300 million short, but also try to reform state government in a way that would make it a little more reflective of the people who were paying the taxes. You know, I mean, taxpayers were not seeing any of the benefits that we as state employees were, so we should try to alter those. And then finally, and this is what probably caused the greatest outrage, was that we were going to require that state employees vote to be part of the union, that they could vote and re-up their union every year or every 2 years. And that's where the union leadership really lost their minds. And that's when it really got incendiary, because they brought in everybody they could at that point to try and stop that provision from occurring.
And I'm going to ask you this question, and I don't think it's a fair question, but...
It's okay.
Do you think, given what happened with Act 10, mm-hmm. Do you think, looking back on it, that had the public known about Act 10 before the election, mm-hmm. that Governor Walker would have been elected?
I have no way of knowing that.
Yeah.
I mean, you can say that about everything. I mean, you know, if I could say that about President Obama. You know, his right. entire campaign was hope and change. We had no idea what that meant. And once we did, we were like, are you kidding me? Wait a minute. A lot of people loved it. But, you know, a lot of us said, oh, my Lord, this can't be. In the same sense, would if Scott Walker had outlined and walked through everything that he was going to do under Act 10, that would have been a campaign issue. But I don't know that they would have been completely able to envision what it was going to mean. You know, it's and in the same sense, I'm not sure that he had developed it up until he was confronted with the budget realities, right, which he didn't get until after he was elected.
Yeah, I guess that's what I was getting at with the previous question, mm-hmm. was it, you know, what was the origins of Act 10?
The origin, without question, was when, as budget director, I walked in and I said, you have a budget deficit that you're going to have to tackle right away. And he said, I've tackled budget deficits in Milwaukee County all the time. I said, not quite like this. And I walked him through where we were and the options that we had and the options that Governor Doyle had used. I mean, he had furloughed state employees. You remember? I mean, right. We're going to have to lay off state employees. We're going to have to do things along those lines. And he really didn't like furloughs. I'm not sure what his concern was, but he really didn't like furloughs. He thought there was an opportunity there for fundamental change that could not just get us through this problem, but get us through, you know, basically put us on more solid footing. And another issue that really was frustrating for a number of us, and this had developed for a long time, was the handcuffs that were on our school boards as far as dealing with healthcare. and I remember dealing with the Holman School Board at times and some of their members and others who said, you know, we'd like to be able to go out and just try and shop around for healthcare for our employees, but they put it in the contracts long ago that in order that for us to provide healthcare to the Onalaska or the Holman or West Salem Teachers Association or employees, we had to go through the Wisconsin Educational Assistance Healthcare Program. You know, the teachers union's healthcare package, and they weren't exactly dealing in ways that we felt were open to free market reforms. And so that was another option where we were going to allow for school boards to go out and find whatever health care they wanted. You know, it's as long as it was comparable to what you were providing, go out and find it wherever you wanted. And that also was kind of a big issue. So it really was fiscally driven. I mean, there's no question. Without that, we wouldn't have had the need to do as much as we did right away.
It takes time to make and the right circumstances to make sweeping changes like you did with Act 10.
Yep.
And I've heard you describe this as something that's going to be a multi-generational impact on the state of Wisconsin.
No question.
Why do you think that?
When we would come either, again, at the state level or at the local level, and I'm meaning specifically the school boards, but even the municipalities. I mean, look at the city of Milwaukee. I mean, Tom Barrett ran against Scott Walker for governor, but Tom Barrett also used the Act 10 reforms to get his city budget in line. You know, so it's provided the elected officials, the school board member, the city council person, the state assemblyman or state assemblywoman, you know, all of those individuals has given them the tools to be able to have greater control over what they're going to do in their budgets and the opportunity to deal with their employees as an employer. And that is multi-generational. That's, you know, the problem was that when I first got involved with it and I would talk to the local school boards, they'd come in and say about 80% of their budget was already decided from the previous budget. They couldn't go anywhere because so much of it is employee and healthcare costs. And those were locked in by contract. There was no negotiating. There's nothing that we can do. They're just going to get this automatic change. And that made it very frustrating and made it for a point where school board members were saying, I don't need to be here. I'm not going to run anymore. You know, don't bother. So that's where I think it's going to be a multi-generational change that's going to affect Wisconsin for a long time.
And there's no way that a Democratic majority, because politics, like everything else, is cyclical. I mean, there will come a time when Democrats control everything again.
No doubt.
They cannot undo this, or you don't think they will undo this?
I don't think they will. Yeah, I think they could. I mean, there's no question, because the unions and the authority that they had were in place by statute. You know, so it's the only reason we were able to get rid of it is because it was in statute. You can change state law. They can do the same. You'll notice that Governor Evers hasn't even suggested changing that back to what it was. I mean, in the campaign, they talked about it a little bit, but that hasn't, knowing that it'll never get through the legislature, perhaps they're not bothering. But could they change it in the future? It's possible, sure. But I also know that the last bastion, really, of of that type of old union thought and that those union houses, if you will, is really in government. I mean, I just heard on, I think it was actually on public radio not long ago, that that union membership in the United States is a very low point. And in the private sector, union membership is less than 10%. I think it was like 6 or 7%. In government, it's still at 33%. A third of government employees are still in some form of union around the country. So it's clear that, that is trailing what is happening in the private sector, and it's going further in that down that path. Where I've said many times, there was a time and a place for the unions. There's no question about it. It was absolutely necessary for school teachers, for state employees, for shop factory workers. You know, everything along those lines. You needed some of the reforms that the unions brought. The problem was that the unions just took it much further than they should have and became their own worst enemy in demanding much more than could be provided, and in fact rewarding and defending mediocrity rather than rewarding excellence.
Okay. This is kind of an historic interview for me. I've never interviewed anybody from the Public Service Commission, either while they were a commissioner or while they were retired, and I don't think many people do.
No, this actually is the first interview I've done in 5 years. So, yeah.
There was a lawsuit late last year that was filed. Mm-hmm. You were named in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it involves the Cardinal Hickory Plan in southwestern Wisconsin. Did that have anything to do with your retirement?
No, not at all. I got to the point where I was 25 years with the state. I knew that I could retire and still do it at an age where I'm young enough. I'm 55, but I still have the ability to go out and find other work and do other things and kind of, you know, go in a different direction. So it didn't. And I only have a little over a year left on my term anyway, and I'm guessing Governor Evers wasn't going to reappoint me. So I just thought, well, right, time to go.
The lawsuit alleges you and another commissioner appointed by Governor Evers should have recused themselves from that decision,
right,
because of conflicts of interest.
Mm-hmm.
Do state ethics laws need to be changed to avoid conflicts involving public service commissioners?
No. The conflict of interest law is strong in Wisconsin. As a matter of fact, the ethics laws, the elections laws, the conflict of interest law, all of those laws, I think Wisconsin is the model for many other states in the country. It's interesting how individuals who don't like the decisions you made are convinced that you are somehow either corrupt or you're on the take or something along those lines. Sometimes it just comes down to, you know what, we just disagree, and that's just the way it is. And that's certainly the case here. I obviously, because it is a lawsuit, I better not speak much about it. But it's one of those things where those who disagree with your opinion are certainly going to find reasons and ways to try and stop it.
I know many of the projects that have come before the PSC, deal with environmental concerns, problems with energy, energy programs that don't have enough sustainability to them,
yep,
or just the not in my backyard argument that comes from residents.
Yeah, the NIMBY, the not in my backyard, the bananas.
How do you weigh all that as a commissioner, though?
You have to take it all into consideration. I mean, that is the challenge of being on the Public Service Commission. You know, it was a significant change from me being in the administration and certainly from being in the legislature. I'm not really able to be lobbied at all. I don't talk to anybody about, you know, that decision. I can read only the record. And so I spend an awful lot of time reading. I'm here in West Salem, you know, an awful lot, but it's mainly sitting there reading, going through public hearing reports, going through testimony, going through technical hearings and everything along those lines, and trying to make myself as educated as I can about the particular issues that are before us. And generally, well, actually, every time a case comes before the Public Service Commission, it's because a utility or some organization wants to build or change something. They want to change the rates they're charging. They want to build this transmission line down through the Driftless area. They want to put up a new oil and gas plant or a solar array, you know, a solar farm. Which is a case that will be the last case I deal with on Thursday. So you make yourself as informed as you can based upon the record that you have before you, as well as obviously the experience you bring to the job. again, your opponents will always feel that you came in with a bias either for the environmentalists or for the industrialists or for whatever. But in the end, I mean, each of us, don't get me wrong, everybody has a bias. I've never, you know, even journalists, I think, are biased a little bit at times.
We can be, yes.
Yes, right. But, I mean, you hide it well. But you have to draw from the record what it is you think is going to be best for the state, best for the community, and whether or not this makes sense to do this particular project. And that's really, you know, all you can do. And what I've done in every one of the projects, I know that's what Chair Vock does, Becky Vock, the new chair, who's just wonderful to work with. I really enjoyed working with her. And Commissioner Nowak. I mean, Ellen Nowak is one of the most knowledgeable commissioners in the country right now. She's been on the Wisconsin Commission for a number of years and brings a great deal of knowledge and influence to the issue. So I think we've got a great commission there, and we're doing the best that we can with the information that's before us.
I don't know as this is in your purview as a commissioner, but people say we are moving fast enough on alternative forms of energy. We're not moving fast enough getting broadband to rural areas.
Right.
It's not your job to make sure that those things are happening.
Well, we can have a role in it. I mean, it's a good question. It's interesting as I've watched even Governor Evers, who just came out and said we're going to be 100% renewable by or 100% carbon free. There's a right. significant difference between renewable and carbon free. But we're going to be 100% carbon free by 2050. And what I've said half jokingly is it's interesting to watch the number of elected officials who are out there saying we're going to be 100% whatever by 20, fill in the blank that I'm no longer in office. So I make a great promise right now. I have no plan on how I'm going to get there, and I'm really not that concerned about it. But right now I can stand for holy pictures. The challenge that we have is that in Wisconsin, well, in most of the entire North, if at any point there is a lack of reliability in our energy, if we have safety problems, if costs become too great, there are significant not only economic but safety and personal health challenges that come. If we have rolling blackouts in January in northern Wisconsin, people die. I mean, you don't get to play that game of, gee, I guess the wind just isn't blowing today or the sun isn't going to shine, so I guess we're going to have to shut off the power. It doesn't work that way. So you have to have that balance as we're moving forward. Will we move toward more renewables? There's no question about it. I mean, there's going to be more wind. There's more solar. If we truly are interested in carbon-free, there should be more nuclear. Nuclear is the cleanest form of energy that is a baseload source that's there 100% of the time. But there, you know, obviously, there are plenty of people who have environmental concerns about spent fuel, and so it's that mix that we have to develop as we're going to go forward of moving away from coal, which I think we've done. We continue to try to move away from coal because that is probably the greatest greenhouse gas emission, to more natural gas because it's lower emissions, but it's plentiful and it's inexpensive right now, mainly because of fracking, which, you know, again, we have the frack sand mine in Sparta and other areas around the country, around the state. So we have more access to gas, which is a lower emission, but it's not in zero emission. We basically only have one nuclear plant left because the other has been shut down. We should be looking at more nuclear. We should be looking to try to develop more because you have to have something that's going to back up wind and solar. We're not a great wind state. I mean, wind is in to the west of us, Minnesota, Nebraska, Iowa. Those are great. And if you want more renewables, and I've said this at the commission table, if you're interested in renewables, if you're really interested in wind, Wisconsin's not a great wind state. We're not going to be able to put up a lot of windmills and wind turbines and power our state. But they can do it in Iowa and Nebraska and those areas. But that means transmission lines, like the one I'm being sued on going through the southwestern part mm-hmm. of the state. So if you want renewables, you have to like transmission. You know, you have no choice. And so that's the challenge of every source of energy that we've got out there. We've got to have that balance. We've got to figure out how we're going to move toward renewable, but it has to be safe, reliable, and affordable. Those are the three tenets of every utility commissioner and every utility in the country. Is it safe? Is it reliable? Is it affordable? And if you also now want it green or, you know, carbon-free, if you're going to add that into the mix, you can't give up any of these other three. You know, so that's the challenge.
So what does your future hold?
That's a good question. I intend to to take what I've learned and knowledge that I've built up. I'm going to form my own consulting company and see if anybody's interested in talking to me at all.
Political or
government mainly. Not really political. I'm not going to run any campaigns or anything like that. But in government, I have obviously a lot of experience in the legislative, executive, and now the utility and regulatory branches of government. And so I think I've got a lot of experience that I can provide to those who may be interested, and hopefully we'll find some who are.
Former Republican lawmaker and political appointee Mike Hipsch of West Salem talked with WPR's John Davis about his 25 years in state government. Hipsch retired from the State Public Service Commission earlier this week. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, including our conversation about a flood risk mitigation project planned for the city of Arcadia, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers.